Welcome to the Cool Tools Show. I'm Mark Frauenfelder, Editor-in-Chief of Cool Tools, a website of tool recommendations written by our readers. You can find us at cool-tools.org. I'm joined by my co-host, Kevin Kelly, founder of Cool Tools. Hey, Kevin.
Hey, it's great to be here.
In each episode of the Cool Tools Show, Kevin and I talk to a guest about some of his or her favorite uncommon and uncommonly good tools they think others should know about. Our guest this week is Aaron Lammer. Aaron is the co-host of the Long Form Podcast, which has interviewed nonfiction writers weekly for over half a decade. He's been writing songs with the music project Francis and the Lights since college, and he lives in Brooklyn. Hey, Aaron, how you doing?
Good. How are you?
Doing really well. This is a treat to have you on the show because I've been listening to Coin Talk and Stoner for a really long time, I actually haven't listened to Long Form, but I'll have to get to that.
You're following an unusual path, which I like, and I'll say that I've been going on Boing Boing probably since pretty close to college. What year did Boing Boing start?
It actually started as like a print zine in 1987. So
that was before my time. I would say on the internet, 2005 maybe I started going. Does that sound right?
Sure. Yeah, we started in 2001 as a blog, and we started the website in 95. So
I think there was a long period of time where I used to do manual data entry, and it was like pretty much Metafilter and Boing Boing all day, every day.
Cool. That's awesome.
So,
Aaron, your podcasts are great and really high quality, very clean sound, and you're like a pro. So, I don't know if you use this tool for your podcast, but Audio Hijack, tell us about it.
I do use it for podcasts. It's actually running right now in the background. So, Audio Hijack is a router for the audio inside your Mac. It's a Mac-only program. And I find there's weird situations. Like if you're trying to copy a quote from an article, you just hit copy and paste. But there's no audio copy and paste for the audio that's just coming out of your speakers all the time. And that's kind of what Audio Hijack allows you to do. It allows you to just record whatever is coming out of your computer, or what's coming out of one specific app, or route one app to another app. So I use it for everything from podcast stuff to like sampling and music to weird one-off situations where I just need like one line from a movie that happens to be on YouTube for some reason. I've used it for all kinds of things.
So like if you wanted to kind of record like a Skype or a Google Hangout, you would be able to do that.
Very easy way to do that. And an easy way to do that the way that we're recording this on separate tracks. So I would record one track from my microphone, and I would record another track from the output of Skype, say, and that would give me separation between the tracks, which is not something I even thought about when I got into podcasting. I don't have like a deep background in audio, but you start running into all of these weird little corridors of audio. And I like it also because I have a program that records Skype, but let's say someone says, hey, no, let's do it on Zoom. You know, the fact that it's just this universal tool, I could basically record anything.
That's cool. So I've been using Audio Hijack, or trying to, for years. Maybe the later versions are better, but I always found when I'm about ready to record something, it's like it makes me restart my browser or restart something before it can do its thing.
The codecs for audio in the Mac are very complex things. This has to do with latency and like really like capturing digital data in real time as it happens. So in the same way that like in Zencastr, which we're using now, if we were to start a new recording, it would kind of have to buffer and move for a second. Mm-hmm. It kind of can't get its brain together and record at the same time. So that is a shortcoming. But what I've found is that if you save presets of your setup, you can get it going really quickly. It's if you have to kind of start from scratch each time that it becomes really onerous.
Yeah.
So there's a way in Audio Hijack to save presets then.
Exactly. Like right now I am running my Zencastr preset, which is anytime I record a conversation on Zencastr, I have it set up this way. I have another one for Skype. I have another one to set up to sample YouTube audio, all these different little one-off things, and it helps label them correctly. So like I'll sometimes get in a situation where I've recorded some weird sample from a 1970s movie that I was pulling off of YouTube, and I'll be like, what is this? Where did it come from? And actually using that auto labeling system, I can see, okay, it was YouTube on this date, on this time. And I'll go back in my YouTube history and be able to pair it up with what video it was recorded from. So it's a pretty powerful tool.
And does it cost? Is it?
I think it's 30 or 40 bucks.
Okay. It's Mac only.
It's Mac only. And I'll say that, I don't know about either of you, but I've experienced Mac dissatisfaction over the last year or two. I got a laptop I really didn't like, and I thought, hey, maybe it's time to give Windows a chance. They've got some nice stuff. And this was the program. This program is so essential to my work life that I would be unable to leave it behind. I would have to keep a separate computer just to run Audio Hijack. So I decided to stick with Mac. And I really like the company, Rogue Amoeba is the company that makes it. And all of their products are fantastic. I use another one of their products called Fission just to convert between different audio formats. Like if I'm posting a podcast and I've got it saved as a high quality MP3, I'll use Fission to make a mono low quality MP3 just to make the file smaller.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, cool. That works. I've used Fission too. Do you ever use Levelator, that free utility that was around for a while?
I've messed around with Levelator, and it's one of those things that's magic and also dangerous. Like you'll use it on one piece of audio and you'll be like, it was amazing. And then you use it on a different piece of audio and it's like destroys it because the yeah. levels are too dramatically different. Yeah. I use this program called Hindenburg to record that has its own leveling function, mm-hmm. which I would also say is dangerous, but does a similar thing. I've gotten more into this program called Isotope RX, which is an audio repair suite. And it allows you to do much more subtle, and it has version history of your leveling and that kind of stuff. So what I'll often do is just keep pushing it, and then I'll be like, I went too far. Need to go back a couple of steps. Mm-hmm. And that's been my leveling style that's recently. Cool.
Since you're like since you know so much more about podcasting and recording, I have one other like inside baseball question. Is there a Please. Way to like get rid of like reverb or you know that echo when you're interviewing somebody and they have like they're in a room that there's really poor acoustics?
That's actually how I got into this Isotope RX7. I'll send the link to it. It's not cheap. It's probably $1,000 for the full suite and mm-hmm. $400 even for the entry level one. Mm-hmm. But it has a utility on it called D-Reverb, mm-hmm. which is the opposite of reverb. Mm-hmm. It's a subtractive reverb, which I didn't even know was possible until they did this, and it will remove echo and reverb. This utility has crazy stuff. It has like de-rustle to take the sound of the wind and leaves out of audio. You can get really in. Cool. And I've used it a few times and gone too far, and you can actually make audio sound completely sterile, almost like it's on like an audio green screen by pulling away every single bit but the voice.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's so cool. Well, I mean, it makes perfect sense. That's kind of like the visual equivalent of like masking in Photoshop.
So I've talked to a few like movie sound designers who I think are the most advanced at this because they're recording real audio on location in extremely challenging conditions and then having to try to translate that to a... And they said basically... They strip everything down and then build everything back up with fake sounds. Ooh. So you like strip the wind out and then you put in fake wind that you can mix and that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. That's Hollywood's approach for sure. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
I mean, all those, you know, all the sound footsteps, all that is all added afterwards. Even if they're recording live, they take it all out and then they do the Foley, recreate all those sounds to their liking.
I've even been seeing my colleague Jay Kang, who I do host Coin Talk with, has been working on some stuff with This American Life. And if you look at a This American Life session, like every little noise is like composed. Like almost none of it is just people talking, playing. It's little bits cut, little bits mixed, little bits of audio added in and out. So really like to do that kind of highly produced stuff, I think you need that kind of fine-tuned control. Yeah.
So I have, I think I have audio jack. I have an older version of it, but I'm going to be needing it in the next couple of days because I'm doing one of these teleconference calls, interviews, and they want to use BlueJeans, which is the IBM or the Microsoft version. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Never heard of it.
Yeah. Well, anyway, and I have used it in the past. Maybe it's Cisco. I can't remember. But so in Audio Jack, I would have within it that I'd have some way to find out how to hijack BlueJeans. I mean, that's what you're saying. I should be able to figure out how to do that.
Okay. Honestly, at the simplest level, if you're not thinking, oh, I'm going to turn this into a high quality radio drama, I often find hijacking the system audio is the simplest thing. You're literally taking whatever is coming into your headphones and recording it. Well, and that's mostly what you want. You mostly just want a verbatim record of everything that was said and heard. So that's what I have running right now. Absolutely, in case we both have a Zencastr failure, I got you guys.
That's great. Thank you. That sounds like the way to do it. Very cool.
A lot of things go wrong, I also would say.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Do they ever. So tell us about your vacuum cleaner.
So this is something that my wife really wanted us to buy, and I was like, I don't get super deep into like home goods usually. And, we bought it and it's just, so it's a Dyson vacuum cleaner. I think it's the V7, which is kind of the flagship model.
Mm-hmm.
It's the best vacuum cleaner I've ever had. And I really think that vacuum cleaning is like one of those central life changing household things. It kind of gives me something to do also. Like I'm not a great deep scrubber. I like to feel like I'm involved, but I don't have a lot of cleaning skills. And this vacuum cleaner, well, the thing I like the most about it, other than it's great, it's cordless, which I'll never go back to a corded vacuum cleaner after this. But it's got this amazing wall mount with this kind of hydraulic lift release to it. It's got a great like feel as it comes on and off, and it's so satisfying putting it on and off that you can really take it off. Like I would spill a very small amount of stuff and I would still be comfortable removing the vacuum and vacuum cleaning it up, which I would never in a million years do with a plug-in vacuum cleaner. So it's kind of opened up this whole new realm of instant cleaning for me. It's a new part of my repertoire.
No, I understand that fully because I have a classic, I'm not even sure what they're called. They're a little carpet sweeper. They're the little thing with a handle and a square thing about the size of a kind of like a big book. And it's mechanical. It's just the brushes. And they use them in restaurants to do spot cleaning on a carpet. And it sits there, but you can, within 5 seconds, you can be sweeping up something on your carpet. And that ability, that instant ability, I think is far undervalued. And you just kind of hit on it, where it's the fact that you can just grab the thing off the wall and then you're vacuuming within 5 seconds. That changes everything.
It reminds me of the difference between when I used to have like a little handheld tape recorder with like a little mini tape in it. And like now I have my iPhone and I have audio memos, and it's like, I just record way more things than audio memos because it's always with me. It's very simple. It's easy to transfer. This is like almost like a weird, like iPhone level vacuuming leap for me, where it's opened up a whole new world of vacuuming for me.
And is it loud or quiet?
It's pretty quiet, although I wouldn't say that's it's like one of its notable qualities. Also, the wall mount, I think, is very forward thinking. Like we get all this stuff, but we don't get stuff to store it. Mm-hmm. So I almost feel like every single thing I acquire becomes this dual task of where do I put it and how do I hang it up? I have a lot of pegboard here in my studio. I'm a very big pegboard person. And this made me think, why doesn't everything like this also come with a mount?
Yeah. Well, that's sort of, you get to a point, at least in our households, we can't bring anything in unless we know where it's going to go. Or we remove something to make room for it. I mean, that's just the rule that we're now at, which is nothing comes in unless we know where it's going to live. Because unless it has a place to live, it just becomes clutter. And so that often means, well, here's where it's going to leave in order to make room for the new thing.
That's so smart.
I put this vacuum in my upstairs bathroom next to my kitchen, which is a very prominent place to put a vacuum. The plug-out vacuum lives like in the basement hallway in a closet. So this has got very prime real estate in my house, and it can only have that prime real estate because it has this beautiful mount, and it's almost something you could admire on the wall. It feels a little bit like The Nest or something like that, where it feels like a high-tech, like smart home feature rather than something that you need to like shove into the back of a closet.
Or hide, yeah. It does have a little bit of kind of like a modern art feel to it, just the colors and this kind of a space age look to it. What about charging? So it still needs to be charged, right? So
the mount is the charger. So whenever it's plugged into the mount, it's charging. So every time you take it off, you have a full charge.
No, but the charge itself has to be plugged in.
Yes, there's a cord coming out of the mount. There's like a thin cord coming out of the mount. Luckily, I had traveled to Japan right before I renovated my apartment, and I put in a Japanese toilet, which required me to put electricity right behind the toilet. So there happened to be a jack available to the vacuum cleaner. Ah, I should have done Japanese toilet on this. Yeah. Has anyone done Japanese toilet yet?
No, not yet. That would be great.
So you're into the little squirting hot water on your butt?
You know, who got me into it is our mutual friend, Craig Mod, who I believe has been on this show. We talked a lot about the functions of the Japanese toilet. And I believe the analogy that he used that's prevalent is if you went out in the woods and were covered in mud, would you clean yourself off with a dry newspaper or a wet hose?
Yeah.
Yes, of course.
I've also heard the pretty gross image of trying to rub peanut butter out of a shag carpet.
That one is maybe even more visceral, I feel like. People get weirded out. I will say people get weirded out by the Japanese toilet, which is maybe why I can't give it like my full like seal of approval. I think it's a great thing in your life. But when people come to stay, or I've had people sublet my apartment before, they always say, oh, well, I didn't use the Japanese toilet. No one seems to speculatively just hit the button and see what happens, which is what I did.
What pushed you what over the threshold? What was the what did someone say to you that made you say, I'm going to try this?
Oh, it was being in Japan where I just felt like the minute I did it, I was like, oh, this is so much more rational. This is so utterly Japanese that they do this better than us. And we have this weird like pride/prudishness that allows us to do something that's not clean. Like the Japanese they're in the right on this one. I think it's just the better way to do it.
And did you research Japanese toilets to come up with a kind of a better one?
I did. There's actually one, as with many, many products, I think, that are made by large Asian companies. There's a bit of a monopoly on the Japanese toilet game. There's one company that makes everything from a very nice entry level $200-$300 Japanese toilet all the way up to, I believe, they have a $10,000 model. Wow. So they have the whole spectrum of luxury, and mine does have heated water. That was my concession. That was my upgrade, I think.
And what kind is it? A Toto or what?
Toto, yes.
Yeah. A Toto, do you remember what the model was?
I'll have to look up what the model is. They're just numbered. Okay. But this is like, if you look on Amazon, if you just go on Amazon, the number one Toto toilet, that's what I have. And I'm a pretty big believer in the wisdom of Amazon in that way, where at least within something like Toto, I'm like, whatever is being bought by Americans, whatever Toto, I'm reasonably comfortable with that.
Cool. You know, I'm doing like the poor man's version, and I bought for every toilet in a house this like $25 cold water bidet attachment.
99% is good. What is that? Brondell makes those or something like that?
Something like that. Yeah, I think so. And it's like cheap. You actually do get used to the cold water and don't even really notice it after a while.
I'm totally in favor. I've thought about doing the rest of my house with some cheaper ones, but there's always one problem, which is if you do one that's electric, you need a plug. And it's very rare that you're going to have a plug in a bathroom right behind a toilet, and an extension cord running across the room to it defeats the Japanese aesthetic entirely.
Yeah. So, and now when I travel, like I just got back from Switzerland and they didn't have bidets in the hotel, I bring these wipes with me called Dude Wipes that are like little moist towelettes. And it's like, you know, the second best thing to having a bidet with you.
The wipes are controversial in my building because I live in a building from the 1800s in New York, and we have we basically just have a gravity line out to the sewer. It got clogged, and we're also a very cheap building, so we do our own plumbing work, and it got clogged, and we like fished way out into it, and it was just like a living creature made of wipes that we pulled out of there.
The wipe monster.
I've learned a lot about how the New York City sewers work, which is really fascinating. There's no inherent flow to them. It's just pressure. Like if there's too much pressure on the system, it blows back into the buildings. The buildings need to maintain pressure to push out to the sewers.
Oh, wow. It's like whoever has the weakest pressure gets it all.
So when there's a heavy rain, sometimes the pressure will come back at us. I have these like gauges on it. We have these hurricane valves, and you can feel them starting to rattle and build up pressure back from the sewer.
Oh my gosh. That's a horror movie.
Well, my studio here is at the sublevel, so I need to think about like where I am relative to the sewers and conduct my grading appropriately.
Yeah.
Okay. Wow. Well, that was a great recommendation. How about another one? Let's lighten the mood a little bit. How about you're a big fan of Apple TV?
I am a big fan of Apple TV. I've always been, so I don't know about either of you. I think I'm kind of from the piracy generation. Like I was in college when Napster came out. I was a big BitTorrent person, and I'm now too lazy for actual piracy. But and I don't really believe in it. I've actually come to feel differently than I did. But it was a real education in getting movie files and music files and trying to play them back. I had all kinds of early systems that kind of predated Sonos, where I would try and wire my whole house, or I would like have six different TVs that were all on a splitter and you could play it anywhere. I wasted a lot of my 20s concocting various systems like this. And the thing that really ended all of my hacky home theater PC kind of stuff was the Apple TV, which is, I think, kind of a maligned product. Am I right in that perception?
I think so. Yeah, it is maligned. Because the old one was like really problematic. It would crash every like couple of hours.
Yeah, the first one gave people a bad reputation. And I think some of the early implementations of AirPlay were also pretty jittery. But it's gotten very good. And the ability to take anything that's sitting on the screen of my phone or my laptop or anything Apple and just mirror it onto the screen of my projector is a lot of the way that I end up using like the sort of TV of my living room. You know, if I want to watch a soccer game and it's not streaming, I'll end up on some weird bootleg Russian stream off of Reddit, and then you can mirror that onto your Apple TV, and now it's on.
You give up piracy.
Well, some of these things you can't get legally in America, so I feel fine about things where it's like, this is just impossible as a commercial transaction. And also just weird, like I'll just end up in weird little situations. Francis, who I work on music with, will send me a rough cut of a music video. And it's like, well, what do I do with this? Do I watch it on my phone? That's not a great experience. And I just find that ability to AirPlay it straight into the Apple TV is probably the thing I use like the most satisfyingly in my whole home technology setup.
And so I don't know about this. So you have, you're watching, I could say, YouTube on your phone, but you air... send it to, you beam it to the Apple TV. Is it going over Bluetooth, or how does it get
It's
there?
Actually Apple's own native standard that uses the Wi-Fi network. So you can send music or you can send video, and it's very literal. You can send both audio or video of literally what's coming out of your phone. I guess this is a theme for me because that's also what Audio Hijack does. But it allows you a pretty robust, I mean, you can stream 1080p, anything straight onto there. We've done pretty cool effects with it, like in the live Francis and the Lights show. Francis, this was not me, but this is just one thing you could do with it, was using his phone on stage to film himself, which was beaming in real time as a mirror to an Apple TV plugged into a projector. This was like, you know, playing places like the Apollo with have a 80 or 100 foot wide stage, huge projection in real time of this slightly latent video from the stage, kind of creating psychedelic effects and that kind of stuff. So it's a pretty powerful tool to be able to take a camera on your phone and have that playing in real time through the Apple TV. And I've also used it for various conference calling kinds of stuff. It's got a lot of functions.
So conference call. So you're doing like a FaceTime on your phone, and then you just project it onto the TV.
Onto the screen. Like I could project my mother calling, and my daughter would be able to see her 6 feet tall on the wall of our apartment.
And does it also operate like a Roku or something where you can just you know, your typical Netflix?
So it's It's got all the apps. I use it for watching all the TV I watch, all of the movies I watch. Everything runs through the Apple TV.
That's really cool. And I think that is the strength of it. Like I have a Amazon Fire Stick, and you can kind of like figure out ways to play through, you know, stream devices to the TV through it, but it's not like Apple. Like we have an Apple TV, and it's just kind of brainless. You just press that little icon on your phone or iPad or your computer, and it's on your TV.
Apple really privileges it, so it has all kinds of rights that you would never get in the Apple ecosystem except using their native stream in that way. I want to send one other shout out to an application called Beamer, which is an ultra simple desktop application. All it does is you drop any file on it and it instantly starts beaming it to your Apple TV.
Wow.
So if you want to watch a movie or something and you don't want to be like, oh, my phone's controlling this. If I pick up a call, it's going to interrupt the movie or the sound. You just drop it on there. I'll sometimes drop it on from a different room and it's just streaming to the TV. I've done that with 30 gigabyte files that are rips of Blu-ray discs. So it can handle anything.
That's so cool.
So like you could do it with a laptop. You could just be moving a file you have in your laptop.
Laptop, desktop, any computer running OS X.
And if it's a desktop, then does a desktop have to have a Wi-Fi
it needs to be, everyone needs to be on the same Wi-Fi network for all this stuff to work, but it doesn't take over the laptop in the sense of it's playing on the screen of the laptop.
It's in the background.
In fact, it's just streaming in the background. So you can continue using the laptop.
Wow. That's so cool. Okay. That's great. You sold me.
That's probably 20 or 30 bucks for Beamer.
Very cool. Uh-huh. That's a really good one. Let's see. So what else do we have here?
We have your fourth one is for an iFixit, which we're kind of familiar with, but tell us about it.
I'm glad you're talking about this.
So I had never encountered iFixit before until I actually was going to make this pick, this little synthesizer I have called the OP1. It's made by a Swedish company called Teenage Engineering. You've talked about it. Okay, great.
Well, that's beautiful.
I didn't want to recommend it because it's currently kind of out of print. Mm-hmm. Like Samsung stopped making the screen. So they're not making more of them right now, but they're going to make more in the future. So you can't buy one right now. They have a new one out called the OPZ, which I have. That's incredible. And instead of a screen, it actually syncs with a little iPhone app. And I think that one's going to be really big too. But since they don't make more OP1s, when mine kind of started to break, because I'm pretty hard on it, and it's a small... It's well built, but you can tell it's hobby built. It's built by a non-industrial kind of company. It's not like you can kind of tell that they've bought individual parts to create the synthesizer rather than say like manufactured them themselves. So my headphone jack started to go out on it, which is a pretty big deal because that's the only way sound comes out of it. And so even when I'm recording it, I just run that into my soundboard mixer. So I was like, oh crap, this is probably it. You know, because I don't usually fix electronics. I can't think of the last, I can't even think of the last time I had like a computer open, even though it was something I would definitely do when I was a teenager, putting RAM in computers and hard drives. I haven't done it in years. So I looked up, you know, fix OP1, and there's this kit on iFixit. literally for this exact fix, which included the little headphone slot, like where the headphone slides in, like that whole thing. And it was basically like that plus the tools to do it. And I think the tools are more or less what you get in that essential toolkit from iFixit. The most useful one is this, it's called a spudger. It looks kind of like a, metal, like a little metal rod with a little like flat paint smear thing on the end of it. Mm-hmm. And it's very useful for kind of taking the back panels off of electronics. There's also very tiny screwdrivers with lots of different little heads to kind of like basically get you into any kind of screws. And the whole fix probably only took me 20 minutes once I had all this stuff.
Things are a lot more repairable if you have the right tools.
Absolutely.
I mean, if you don't have it, it's really hard to get open, but you can open up with this kind of stuff.
Usually I feel like I'm threatening to break it too. Like the tools made me feel like, oh, this will work. Like I could see, I was like, okay, there's a guy with this tool and it just pops right off. Normally when you're testing that barrier of plastic, you're kind of saying, if this doesn't work, I'm just cracking the back off.
So did it work? Were you able to repair it?
Yeah, I repaired it. It's working now. I'd actually say it's better than the original because it's got a more robust headphone jack now. And it actually paid extra dividends because, so I have all these old mini discs from when I was in college that include rehearsals of that band that we started working on shortly thereafter, which became Francis and the Lights. And it has just all kinds of media on it that I wanted to get off. So I bought this mini disc player on Craigslist for $20 and it was not working. And so I looked it up and I opened it up and I was also able to fix it. And it flooded me with great joy. I would have almost paid for the elation of the feeling that I had successfully fixed this mini disc player and could play back these mini discs. And then I started playing them and I was insanely tedious and it made me remember all of the ways that it was kind of a crappy technology in the first place.
I find you were just talking about the flood of joy that you had but in fixing something. That's one of the reasons I go to YouTube now I am much more bolder in attempting to fix things because you can actually find out how to do it. You can actually get links to where you can get these obscure parts. And There is very little joy as great as fixing something that seemed to be broken. And I think it's underappreciated how much exhilaration there is in doing that.
So true.
It made me realize that in the case of this company, Teenage Engineering, that makes these little synthesizers, a lot of the value of their products is they have this community built around them because they are these semi-DIY products that there's real enthusiasts of that. Like this new one I got, the OPZ, it only came out 6 weeks ago and there's probably only 2, maybe 5,000 of them in the world. And there's already on YouTube people who've put up 2-hour-long tutorials about how to use them.
Wow.
There's multiple videos about how to open up and repair the OPZ, which is only 6 weeks old, and how to do various hardware upgrades to be able to hook it up to 3D video systems and that kind of stuff. So I really am realizing that with a lot of these products, you're buying into these larger ecosystems that have their own ethos. And if there's a ethos of open it up, work on it, fix it, that's usually like a rich overall community.
Yeah. Yeah. That is a good point that you don't really want to buy a product. You want to buy a product plus a community.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what got me into Reddit, honestly, like, which I was always a little skeptical of and had, you know, various sort of media person cynical views about. But if you get into the right Reddit for people who are really, really into something like one of these synthesizers, it's like, it's more valuable than any course you could take or a music lesson you get. Cause these are like people who've like dedicated years of their lives just to this one product.
It's so true.
Yeah.
It's so true.
Tell us about what you're up to or what you'd like people to know about you or where they can go to hear more about what you're up to.
So I'm currently in the somewhat overloaded position of hosting three podcasts that are all producing new episodes. The most well-known one is called Longform. It's interviews with journalists. I also, in the last couple of years, have started two podcasts, which I'm pleased to say that Mark has listened to both of. Thank you. Stoner is a podcast I started about creative people and their relationship to marijuana. And I have a show called Coin Talk with my friend Jay Kang. We both got kind of unhealthily obsessed with crypto around the same time, and are neither of us very knowledgeable about it. So we do kind of a show about that ignorance and about us trying to wrap our heads around it. It's a pretty funny show, I would say.
It's really funny, but it's also good because you're coming at it from a non-expert point of view, which makes it super accessible, I think. You know, you are knowledgeable about what's going on, but you aren't like talking about like the technical guts of how like the blockchain actually works and, you know, consensus algorithms and all that kind of stuff. And you take a higher level approach and you bring in a lot of the personalities out there. You know, people pretending to be Satoshi Nakamoto and like the Bitcoin Cash people.
We dig the crypto culture.
Yeah, that's what it's about, I think, is the culture. And that's what makes it so good.
That's a wonderful way to put it.
Kevin, I'm curious what you have to say about this. Like, it feels in crypto like every person who's been into it for 18 months considers themselves a world expert and everyone else an idiot. Was the early internet that way? Like, was every person who, how did people like sort of sort out expertise in the early years?
If there was a switch, I mean, I think the early internet people were dismissed by most people as completely being on the margins and not cool. There was no coolness factor at all. At that time, whereas crypto came in kind of, it was the cool people who were doing it, but in the early days of the internet, it was the uncool people who were doing it.
The people in crypto think that they're the uncool people too. There's something about an underdog narrative in both of these where both communities feel like it's them versus the world and that everyone is out to get them and to stop them from realizing this inevitable vision.
Right, exactly. Maybe there are some similarities then. If people want to, they go to CoinTalk and then,
medium.com/CoinTalk or just search for it in a podcast app. I always tell people podcasts are one of those weird things that are kind of post URL where you just like the name is the URL, you know, just a app of your choice. And that's always weird about podcasts. It's almost feels like a non-web medium at times. I don't know if you ever feel that way or when you're telling about someone about it. It's hard to explain it. You just have to say, just go for it. It won't be hard. Just subscribe.
Do you listen? Do you use Overcast for when
I do.
You listen?
I do listen to Overcast. I've been a fan of Marco Arment and his software development for a long time, but mostly I just sort of get stuck in my ways. I'm not even like a super huge podcast listener. I guess that's a dirty secret to reveal, but I have my things I listen to and my slate is almost full with the stuff I've been listening to for a long time. So I end up just sort of opening Overcast and I don't even get out of the same show sometimes.
Yeah, I hear you. Aaron, thanks so much for taking the time to talk to us. It was great, you know, as a listener to your podcast. This has been a lot of fun, and I really appreciate it.
Yeah, it's really great, and we love your picks and your tools. We could have talked for another hour, I'm sure, and maybe we'll have to do this again, but thanks for joining us.
Ask me back anytime. I have a lot of stuff. I actually, when I was prepping for this, read back through a bunch of your archive and was just opening up various people's picks. And I just started buying stuff. It just opened up like a flood of buying. I don't know what it is. I think I had my first child about a year ago. And sometimes at night I just blow off steam by buying things on the internet. It's a little bit of a dangerous habit, but it's one of the few things you can do with just no energy at night. And you guys have given me a great source of new crap to buy.
You're very welcome.